The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to MotoGP OD, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. My name is Jim Race, and this is episode number 215 for Friday, February 19th. And for the second week in a row, and I'm very pleased to have him back. And thank you for the feedback from the listeners. But Martin Darlington, how you doing?
Hi, Jim. And not too bad at all. And hello, everyone, from yet again snowy UK.
Yeah, you guys got snow again today. It was like a little bit, I'll have you know that at least I couldn't do the conversion for you, but it's basically 70 degrees here and sunny.
Thanks. Yeah, it's like 2 degrees centigrade. I have no idea what that is in Fahrenheit because I've grown out of that, I've left it behind. But it wasn't really snow. It was more slush.
Okay.
We had slush this morning.
Cool. Well, we've got today on the show, we've got a... And it's really cool because it's kind of a continuation of a lot of the things that you and I talked about last week, only going into a lot of it in a little bit more detail and insider type stuff with Liam Schubert. And so it's a long interview. We do have a bit of ground that we should cover today, and so let's get right into that. A quick listener email. We had plenty, got a really cool series of them from Kevin Winter, and thanks, Kevin. And he asks a question. He says, any scuttlebutt out there, I think scuttlebutt, is that an Americanism? Have you heard that?
I think scuttlebutt is rumors, news on the grapevine.
Yeah. Okay, good.
I think it's a U.S. Navy term, which has drifted into the Royal Navy. Ah. And if I'm correct, is Kevin from Australia?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I can't remember.
I'd have to check, but,
he's definitely from somewhere.
Aren't we all? Yeah. Anyway, any scuttlebutt out there on the 125s potentially turning faster lap times than the Moto 2 bikes? In the last few years, it seemed pretty typical for the top guys in each class to be about 5 seconds a lap apart. Obviously this depended on how fast or flowing or tight a track they were on. But to me, on average, it was about 5 seconds. Now, here's my thoughts. You know, we talked about this last week, too, and it's still kind of an ongoing issue. We do not yet know, and in fact, Liam and I talked about this in the interview, what really the real Moto2 engines are going to put out. Until that happens, I don't think we'll know. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, you look at it on paper, and at the moment on the testing times, the World Supersport bikes have been beating the Moto2 bikes on an average. The 125 testing have been potentially beating them. Once they get up and running, I can't see a prototype 125 being faster on average than a prototype chassis and production engine 600 Moto2. Unless, I mean, I think there may be some overlap on some of the tracks. As we discussed earlier in the pre-show, Jim, that Laguna Seca is still going to be premier class only. But there, maybe Sachsenring. Possibly it would have been at Donington, which sadly looks like it's just going to become part of the Derbyshire landscape. It may have happened. I can't see it happening at the faster tracks. But certainly by the end of the season, maybe the first couple of races. But you do occasionally get those overlaps, don't you, where the back end of an upper class is slower than the fastest end or the top end of the next class down. So it'll be interesting and potentially embarrassing.
It does kind of make you wonder in a way. And I've thought about this in the past. I'm like, well, let me see. If the fastest guys in 125... can run to where they'd be, you know, in the middle of the pack in 250. Why don't you just go let them run? But racing doesn't work like that because it's racing is all about closing speeds as far as safety goes. When you're hauling ass down a straight. The key is to not come up on somebody much fast, because basically everybody goes into the corners at about the same speed, but they certainly do not go down these long straights at the same speed. And that is a big difference. Although, but still fun to think about. Thanks for that, Kevin. Totally appreciate it. We'll have to see. I think it's just an unknown right now, and we can't know until the motors come. And they're still not even going to be there for this weekend, which is okay. So not weekend, today or this week, where they are testing. In Barcelona, or they're trying to test, or Catalunya. Because it was a wet affair for the majority of the day. There were a few guys that went out in the wet and got in, 20, 30 laps, but not a whole lot to report. The next 2 days, and of course we're recording this on a Wednesday, so Thursday and Friday, the weather sounds like it's supposed to be better, so we're kind of going to be a little bit behind on the news, but of course you can follow that at MotoGP.com or your favorite local output center. Next up, and this is going to tie into something that I'll let you talk about for World Superbike, but Jorge Lorenzo, or Lorenzo, for those of you that don't like to pronounce that way, has basically been announced because of his injury from running motocross. We knew he wasn't going to be at Malaysia, and now they're saying he's kind of iffy. May not even make the Qatar test, which,
which is only, is it 2 weeks before the Qatar race?
Indeed.
Yeah.
And that's a shame. We both said last week, we're like, hate it when somebody goes into the season, especially somebody, that's way up near the top. Because frankly, I think it's a disadvantage. And it create, he may be able to surmount it. But I don't know. What do you think?
I think the problem, a part of it, I mean, not having been a racer, it's hard to judge, but half it might be the psychological feeling of, I've got to be behind the drag curve. So there's that immediate pressure to try and push hard and catch up. And I think if we look at last year's season with James Toseland, obviously there's an awful lot of British focus landed on James. The two crashes he had in pre-season, I think it's not so much it knocked his confidence as it made him scared of the bike, but it just put massive pressure on him. I'm playing catch up, so he's got to push that a little bit harder. Just as in the 2008 season, when he went to Donington and he had the Cross of St. George Leathers and it was all this, home crowd. He didn't qualify well. He started quite poorly. Massive pressure. Must get to the first corner and take some people, get past some people. And cold tyres, and as we all know what happened, he crashed. And you just think, I just wonder how much. Now, one thing I've noticed with Lorenzo, he seems to be able to compartmentalize areas of his life incredibly effectively. So whether he can just put this to one side and just say, nah, I just carry on with what I was doing, I just do what I know I can do, and I don't try and push outside my limits. If he can, it'll be phenomenal.
Yeah, I think so too. The one worry that I would have is that, and as you say, it does build pressure upon a rider, is that he would try and come out of the box, much like he did his first year, and over push in a way, if you will.
Yeah.
And we all know
what
happened his first year. I mean, he came out and he was fantastic, but clearly he ran into some issues and fought through injury. We'll see. Wednesday. The FIM MotoGP Commission came out with a whole bunch of stuff, and I want to try and keep this short because I want to get to the interview, but a bunch of updates for the 2012 regulations. And I'm going to run through these one at a time. We'll do a quick commentary. We know that they're going to have both 800 and thousands now. And people said to me when I said that before, they're like, you're crazy. I'm like, okay, well, no. For the 800s and the thousands, so the 800s are now going to have a 3 kilo weight advantage, which would be good. Still going to be stuck to 6 engines and a fuel capacity of 21 liters. Not all that different, right? But the thing that was really unique was for the privateers. Privateers basically get a break, and they're going to have different limitations. And what those are is they can use 12 engines a season. And, you know, this is all subject to modification between now and then. I think it was a long time, right?
Yeah.
But a fuel tank capacity of an additional 3 liters. And you remember I mentioned last week about fuel.
It's a huge issue, I think.
Yeah. Yep. And in fact, in the interview with Liam, I talked to him about fuel capacity, and you'll find something rather revealing in there as far as his personal opinion on it. They're going to change. You know, they're going to kind of get this all down pat by the end of May, but they'll probably lock it in then. Another thing is the claiming rule is back. Now, if you remember last year in Moto 2, initially they defined a claiming rule for the engines, which was going to be, you know, 20 grand, I think. 20 grand for the engines when these were going to be unique engines, not done by Honda. And it was essentially to try and keep people from building monster stuff. And at the time, I'm like, there's no way that's going to work. We'll have to see how that goes. Go ahead.
I have issues with the claiming rule, and I think it was Jules who came up with the point that if a satellite team, a small team with a low budget, were to develop an engine within the rules that was incredibly effective, and you look at Formula One, which all they did with the double underbelly thing, that whatever it was that made, I don't follow it that closely, the
diffusers.
Yeah, the diffusers that made everyone so, and then everyone protested. If that sort of thing happened with a claiming rule on an engine, then Honda or Ducati or Yamaha factory, with the money they've got, what's the stop them saying, yeah, we'll have that? And they can buy these engines at $20,000 or whatever the set price is, and then the satellite teams have got to, you know, develop another or build another one. And I might be missing something fundamental about this rule, but it just seems a bit too easy to cripple someone. Oh, hang on, they're doing better than we want them to. Right, well, we'll just buy their engines.
It's not,
and turn them into ashtrays, you know.
Yeah, exactly. It's not clear yet. Well, and especially if you've got, you know, back-to-back weekend races, but it's not clear yet. From what I understand, and I'll gather more. You know, a lot of this news basically came out not so long ago. I mean, like hours ago.
Sure.
And I think the claiming rule is actually going to apply to various other parts of the motorcycle as well, which is not unusual in motorcycle road racing across various venues. The thing is that it's kind of developed a stigma, if you will, if people do that kind of thing and just, you know, claim for evil purposes. In fact, there's a really classic story about Yoshimura Suzuki in the States. Some club racer claimed Matt Mladen's, you know, forks, and when the Yosh techs pulled him off the bike, they basically did their best to destroy them by, you know, cranking all the adjusters down and et cetera, et cetera. Or so the story goes. I will leave it at that. But it sounds quite plausible. Let's roll
just
on.
Just a quick interjection in the gym. Just reading it again, These new regulations will be further defined by the end of May, with these teams to be referred to as claiming rule teams, which you might infer as meaning that the only people who can claim are the satellite teams.
That's how I read
it. So possibly, right. So in that case, that blows my comment there out the water, that the factory teams wouldn't be in the same pool anyway. They wouldn't be able to claim. So if it's just between the satellite teams, I don't think it'd be a huge issue.
Well, as we say, you know, between now and then, who knows what.
Stand by for May, yeah.
Or even now in 2012. The rules have proved over the last last 10 years to be incredibly fluid. And you kind of never know what's coming down the pike. We'll have to see. Okay. Sure. There was another interesting thing that I heard in their announcement that I reached out to Liam for some thoughts and clarification on. For the forthcoming season, next year, tire pressure sensors will not be allowed. Apparently, tire temperature sensors are already prohibited. So I thought the tire pressure sensors was an interesting thing, and I couldn't quite off the top of my head see the logic in it. So I called Liam. Thank you, Liam. He was under his car changing his oil, and he still took my call. He basically says it's likely a cost-cutting measure. Our Marchesini wheels, which are pretty much the top of the peak and what a whole bunch of the teams use, have tire pressure sensors built into them that have the capability to actually speak to the traction control system. And when they can do that, the traction control system can make adjustments based upon what the tire pressure is. And I'm like, Oh, that's cool. But it's expensive. It's supposed to be really, really expensive. And so his thought was that it's a cost-cutting measure. And that makes sense to me. But the other thing that those do, the tire pressure sensors, is in the morning at a race or, practice day or whatever, on the tire racks, they've got blankets on all these tires, and those essentially automatically come on in the morning and start, even before people arrive, and start bringing the tires up to temperature. And bringing up to temperature, you also want to be able to monitor the pressure. And those sensors talk to these tire racks.
The tire warmers.
Yeah.
Wow.
You can see why it's expensive.
Yeah.
And so I think it's, one of the things that they're trying to control, there is kind of a very slow effort, it seems like, to reduce traction control. Liam makes a really good point in the bit you guys will hear later about how we're probably not ever going to see, the old hardcore sliding stuff that we've ever had before. And I won't give it all away. But all right, let's roll on.
But that technology won't be wasted because it will be coming to a BMW Tourer near you in the next year or two. No doubt.
Indeed. And, it's on road cars all over the place right now.
This is the point. I know that Bob and yourself and Jules have discussed this over the years about does MotoGP – Bob would say they have an obligation to allow them to develop technology because we get the trickle down onto road bikes. But onto street bikes, at the same time, as we saw – a couple of years ago, it can make for some pretty dull racing.
It can.
It's a difficult balance to strike.
It is. And I'll leave that hanging there because...
Yeah.
Because you'll kind of hear some of that in the interview with Liam because we kind of touch on some of that stuff too. An additional thing that I thought was very interesting since, Moto2 is... sort of ran this week, but we'll certainly have more on Thursday and Friday. It's a really cool procedure that they came out for the Moto 2 teams. And you know, you and I were talking last week about, you know, they were testing these engines, you know, hardcore to make sure they didn't go bang. Well, the Moto 2 teams next year are going to have the capability of requesting a replacement engine. And this is a quote: request a replacement engine on the grounds of substandard performance. And I applaud that. I think that's cool.
But who's going to define that? Because I read that bit and I was thinking, yeah, I can see that. You know, going down the straight, we were 11 kilometers an hour slower than, you know, X team. But the gearing's down to the team. You know, the wheel size is down to the team at the end of the day. You know, how that would be defined would be quite, I would have imagined, would be quite a tricky technical process to go through. So again, I mean, this is way, way above my kind of pay level, how this sort of thing's decided. But I think it's a good step to make that, you know, you're all running on supposedly the same engine. So if you think you've been stitched, you can ask for a replacement. How many requests will be met with a replacement engine? How many will be met with a, no, your engine's fine, we've checked it. Remains to be seen, but...
Maybe they'll run a dyno, dynamometer and, you know, test it that way. Although that's a great way to beat up engines. You got another little bit here, and I'm going to let you run with it because I loved it.
Wait, is this about Brock?
No. Wilco.
Oh, no.
Roger Wilco.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this was just something I was reading up. I think certainly Jules became aware that, you know, admire Valentino as I do. I've become a bit of a Jorge Lorenzo fan over the last couple of years. Didn't expect to be when he came from 250s. Absolutely blown away by the lad. Read his book. Loving to death. Was a bit concerned when his team manager left, but his new team manager, not only is he, as we were discussing earlier, got a solid background in 250 GP racing. He's a proper bike racer himself. Has he got the coolest name or what? Wilco Zeelandberg. I cannot, unless that Yorkshire stalwart Deuteronomy Pistlethwaite turns up, trying to write, and the only background he's got is making pies, so he's not likely to make it into the MotoGP paddock. But Wilco Zeelandberg, or probably Vilco Zeelandberg. How cool is that name? If anybody has got a better name for anyone who's been involved with MotoGP, I'd love to hear it. Because can you imagine saying, who's your boss? Wilco Zeelandberg. No, you just made that up. That's Baron Munchausen. You can't have a name like that. Fantastic.
Yeah, he's he does have an actually really good and relatively storied background in 250s. But... and as we chatted before, you know, he was Cal Crutchlow's team boss. So clearly, he knows how to put together a winning effort. We'll have to see. But, yeah, the name is, as you say, rather unique.
Well,
kind of cool. Kind of cool. All right. Let's zip through this a couple more things. World Superbike. There's still a whole bunch of people heading down to Phillip Island, and that exodus is still underway. Some people are kind of hanging back, but I imagine that will be done pretty quickly. And you told me something today I didn't even know about, Brock Parks.
Yeah, this has come out on Motorcycle News today. Brock Parks has suffered yet another, not that Brock Parks has had them before, motocross accident. Mm. Broken his leg. He's having a pin fitted today, I believe. He's crashed whilst training on a motocross bike, broken his leg, had to go straight to hospital, had a four-hour operation to insert a pin.
Ow.
In fact, sorry, no, I think that was yesterday. It went well, but he's going to miss the PI race. He's hoping to be back in time for Portimao. But yet again, we think of Keenan Sofloglu last year, Jorge Lorenzo this year, Brock Parks this year. Neil Hodgson nearly died. Neil Hodgson, for those who have forgotten him, World Superbike World Champion and BSB Champion, racing in AMA last year. He nearly died in a motocross accident. Was very lucky to survive. He's back to fitness, back in BSB, but motocross, dangerous hobby.
Nicky Hayden, Florida, a landing in Supermoto at the X Games a couple of years ago.
Yeah, Randy DePuno broke his ankle last year during the summer break, didn't he? And so Brock's out, which is a real blow, I think, for the Echo CRS Honda squad.
Yep.
On last year's Stiggy Hondas, or they're using last year's Stiggy Hondas. So, you know, as we discussed earlier, motocross riding, obviously really, really good for the guys to you know, throttle control, particularly for wet riding. But, wow, it's taking its toll.
Indeed. Okay. Let's go ahead and listen to the interviews. It is a two-part bit, and then we'll come back and we'll close the show out. Roll. Hey, this is Jim Race for MotoGP OD, and on the line list we have an old friend of the show, Liam Schubert. How are you this afternoon, Liam?
I'm doing great, Jim. Enjoying the rainy California weather we've been having for the last month, it feels like. But other than that, things are good. GP got started, you know, officially with the Ground Zero testing in Sepang. And it'd be nice to talk a little bit about that. And the fact that because the schedule's changed so much from recent years with the limited testing, I didn't notice an ERTA test, traditional ERTA test, that usually takes place in Barcelona or Jerez. And the fact that it seems to be the testing is being done at Sepang twice in a row, and then there'll be a test in Qatar and then a race. So definitely they're shipping the material a lot less than they would be for standard testing, where you've got to go to Sepang or Australia, then you come back to Europe and test there, then you go out to Qatar. You know, logically, you send your material to Malaysia for the first test, and then you're going to leave most of it there for 3 weeks. You know, maybe take some pieces back to repair, whether it's body work or, you know, sensitive computer equipment. And then you're just going to fly back to Sepang and pick up where you left off. So in the team aspect, it's a lot easier and cheaper to test at the same place twice in a row. And for the mechanics, they're not having to break down the garage, pack it up, ship it out, and then unload it and set it up again. So that's a nice thing for them. As far as preseason testing, you know, new vehicles, new designs, unfortunately, you know, they'll be testing twice at the same place. So I don't know how much data is going to be gleaned unless people are radically changing things on the bike between the first test and the second test. But yeah, let's get into a bunch of stuff, Jim.
Okay.
Been a while.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of themes that you talked or touched on in there. But yeah, let's talk about Sepang a little bit. And let me just quickly run through the top 10 for the weekend, so we've got some context, right? We had Rossi, Stoner, Lorenzo, Pedrosa, Ben Spies, perhaps a new alien, Dovey, Edwards, Hayden, Espargaró, a little bit of a surprise, and Caparossi. Yeah, I'm surprised to see him that far down, but that's kind of a signal to me because he's you know, Suzuki's and historically have always been fast there, but he was in 10th. What do you think of that firing order?
The firing order appears to be pretty close to how I picture the season to end. Okay. Obviously, you've got the factory teams up front with Rossi and Lorenzo right in the mix. You've got both Repsol Hondas right up there. And, you know, personally, I do think Pedrosa is the faster rider between him and Dovizioso. So, no surprise there. Good to see Ben Spies getting in the mix as he's getting more acclimated to the machine and how much work it is to actually set it up to perform at its best. You know, I read some interviews with him. I can't place the magazine or whether or not it was online. But he mentions that there's a lot more to set up electronically in order for the bike to work the way the rider needs it to work, and then also for him keeping up with other riders. He mentioned that there's a clear difference between a superbike and a GP bike, mm-hmm. and him and Houseworth have got to tune themselves up in the off-season you know, during this testing in order to be competitive when the year starts. You know, those are the top five. I'm glad to see Hayden up there. Obviously, something's working for him. And a little surprised at the Suzuki just being down on overall speed. You know, like you mentioned, traditionally they've been up there usually pretty quick in preseason testing. And one thing to mention that people may have forgotten is that Suzuki has been on Bridgestones for years, and Bridgestone always went well in Malaysia.
Yep.
So, you know, that might account for why traditionally Suzuki's been fast at that racetrack.
But now everybody has them.
Yes, now everybody's on Bridgestone. And secondly, you know, people are trying to flex their motors in the preseason because you want to see what's going to happen, what's going to break, because the new regulations that stipulate 6 engines for 18 events, you know, that's mind-boggling to me because the number is so small. You know, barring crashes, just there will be mechanical failures that we should see this year simply because the engines are going to be so stressed. And to give you an idea, you know, roughly, you know, it's usually teams change one engine per weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You put a fresh engine in for your race bike, you run it that weekend, then maybe the following weekend you spend Friday and Saturday finishing off the miles on it until it reaches its limit, then you change the engine again. So typically, motors are being shipped out one per rider minimum during the normal season, but now that the rules say 6 engines per weekend, they're more than tripling the mileage, and that's a lot of metallurgy to work with. You know, other people have mentioned we're going to see lower RPMs, and, you know, honestly, I don't think that's going to happen. People will find a way to keep the RPMs up because you need to make the power with such limited fuel supply. It's going to be fun to watch, but by the same token, the way people said, oh, I'm not a fan of Michelin or I'm not a fan of Bridgestone, I don't want to see a tire war. Well, guess what? Now we're going to have an engine war, and this is where the real, you know, the strength of the factories is going to come in, because, you know, I think, honestly, the people with more engineers working on different aspects of the engine should theoretically have a better engine, you know, as far as reliability and being able to generate power for that many kilometers.
Yeah, you know, and the thing that just kind of really rubs me the wrong way is that in theory, this was being done, you know, classic Carmelo thing, it was being done to reduce costs, and you know that it didn't. They spent a shitload of, redesigning all this crap to try and figure out how to extract, you know, just as much horsepower out of an engine that will last, you know, n number of kilometers. And you're like, what the hell? I mean, it's frustrating.
I don't know if I'd say what the hell. It's just difficult as far as World Championship Series go. When you look at what kind of power they're producing in World Superbike and how often those engines are getting revised,
yeah.
Now we've got a 20% smaller capacity motor that needs to make roughly the same horsepower, but now the mileage has increased more than 3 times,
mm-hmm.
You know, even what a Superbike or a Supersport spec motor is going to do. You know, when I look at how many miles you can get out of, you know, even bikes that race in the AMA, if you look at the 600s and how many miles or kilometers those engines will do before they're completely overhauled, you know, with new pistons, crank, conrods, everything, before everything gets replaced, you know, the GP engines theoretically are going to be lasting 3 times as long as an AMA 600. So it's baffling that this cost-cutting measure is coming in. At the same time, usually the cost-cutting measures that are implemented in GP do have a trickle-down factor for the factories. And we see that already in evidence based on all the bikes from the factories that are Euro 3 compliant and emissions compliant, simply because what they may have already learned from 2003 when they first went to the 4-strokes, and then as the 4-stroke fuel limit kept getting reduced, they had to learn how to make power and run lean. You know, that's trickling down to our street bikes.
It's true. And no, I totally agree with that. You know, I had there. There was a feeling in me, just prior to when they made the announcement that in 2012 and maybe even 2011, who knows, that they're going back 2000s, and now it's even more muddled because there may be a whole mixed bag. But what I really wanted was to basically just have them open up the fuel limits at first. I thought that at first, and I got some hate mail about it. People are like, no, it's an engineering challenge, blah blah blah. And I'm like, what?
There's enough engineering challenges in this
I
race
know.
series.
That was my thought exactly. But it seemed like a very simple fix to me.
No, because ultimately, I don't care how technologically advanced the bike is and how good the rider is. The rider's job is to make the machine go around the racetrack the fastest. And the ultimate contact point, the first and the last, are the tires.
True.
So I don't care how much horsepower you give these bikes, we're never going to revert to the tire smoking, sideways, crossed up action that we had with the 990s, because the tires have evolved. And the tires are not going to take a step back to give us that. It would be a drastic evolutionary change to get an 800 in the corner that way.
But Gary's coming back.
Yes, on a mystery machine, three-cylinder.
Yeah.
I wish Gary all the best, because I've always considered him a friend.
Yeah.
Him and his wife have been just fantastic to me and my girl, and we've had many good conversations. And I don't have another word but plucky, but Gary's really plucky, and I wish him all the best. I mean, every success in the world, you may recall he was one of the last guys to put a two-stroke on the front row. And I'm hoping he can take this outsider, kind of a wild card FB Corsa machine, and do something special with it. But, when we look back at the development that Gary's been instrumental in, and that was basically sliding the rear through corners, that was a particular era where Michelin gave him the softest tire, and he was able to use the machine's power to ride over the tire. Now we've seen that everybody has to ride with the wheels in line. Passing is more difficult. Sliding slows you down. I don't think he's going to get a tire for Bridgestone that he's going to be able to use in that way to take another step forward, as far as overall development. I do think that he's still plenty quick.
Yeah.
So I hope he shocks a couple of the youngsters, because let's face it, Gary's not the biggest guy out there, and that's going to play into his advantage.
I sincerely hope that, and you're right, he and Gemmer are just great people. And my big hope is that there is something in the FB Corsa bike, because there are, frankly, as you said, it's a mystery machine. There are a lot of questions about it. In fact, the FIM hasn't even, authorized it yet, which is interesting, because I always thought they just let people in. They let Ilmor in when they were still on night.
Ilmor had a lot of weight behind it.
Well, yeah.
And a lot of power, which I think pulls a lot of weight if you can say, we've got all these guys from F1 that are working on this vehicle. That carries a lot of weight.
True. True.
However, as we saw in practice, or not, an actual practice, but as we saw in reality, it's a lot more difficult for car people to kind of work on a dynamic motorcycle chassis application. Perhaps if the Ilmor had four wheels, they would have had the fastest kart on the planet, and I've spoken with Andrew Pitt, I've spoken with Gary about it, and the machine was incredible. I mean, to be honest, the Ilmor, flat out, hands down, was unique in the way that everything went together so perfectly. I felt that every component on the bike was CNC machined, and the whole bike was done on the computer, so that everything butted up perfectly and fit perfectly and screwed in, even to the point where the bottom of the fuel tank, which, was under the seat, and the back section of where a standard fuel tank will be, the bottom of that section had fins on it, for cooling.
Really?
It was so well thought out in physical dimensions, and everything about the bike was just so beautiful. The workmanship and the craftsmanship was unbelievable for a racing machine. It seemed like the downfall was the electronics, according to Andrew and Gaz. So, you know, I hope that FB Corsa can use that type of technology as far as building a beautiful bike and having a screamer, because truthfully, the Ilmor was loud, and I had never heard a bike like that before. They would fire it up regularly in the garage, inside the garage, and just make a symphony of racket, enough that in the neighboring garages, everybody in my garage would have to put on headphones and plug their ears when they were warming this bike up because it was so loud. But let's hope they get some good software people to get the bike sorted, and then hopefully Gary points them in the right direction and they start making ground on everybody if it's legalized.
Yeah, and I think that's the key. You know, they will find out. You know, I don't think they would be continuing down this path, and I don't think Gary would be joining on to the venture unless there was the inkling of an opportunity to actually be competitive. So best wishes for them. I do have to ask you, in going back to the first part that we talked about, because there were a couple of avenues to lead off that. You and I had a little bit of a pre-talk. The in theory, intrigue about the computers disappearing from the Aspar garage. And you had some thoughts on that. You want to refill me up?
Sure. Well, first of all, we know that the Aspar team is most of the 250 squad that was with Alvaro Bautista running his 250 bike last year. Now, several of the mechanics and the data guy step up to take care of the Barbara machine in MotoGP, but ultimately the main electronics guy is going to be from Ducati Corsa. And this being their first outing with the bike, I would presume that most of the material, including the bikes, the spare parts and whatnot, shipped directly from the factory in Italy right to Sepang. So everybody arrives at the racetrack. You know, they're unpacking the boxes, putting the bike together. And, you know, maybe if something was missing, they said, oh, you know, where is this? What happened? And it's possible that maybe it got left back in the factory or, you know, it's in a flight container for another team. We really don't have much information about it. I've made some inquiries, but I haven't heard back yet. And, you know, until I see more information from other websites or other people on the ground, I don't put a lot of credence into it, simply because everybody that works with a computer in 125, 250, and GP, you know, never to leave your computer overnight at the racetrack. This is why everybody's got a backpack or a trolley, just so you can move your computer and your charger and everything else back and forth to your hotel room. You never leave your computer out in the open, and you never leave it where it could be nicked.
I understand that. It did seem a little bit odd to me, especially, you know, maybe if you were in a location where you actually had a good grasp of what the security was, but I don't...
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. You could, you know... All the paddock garages lock up, and every team knows that, you know, they're going to be leaving the hardware and the motorcycle apart and whatnot overnight, so you lock your garage doors, but you know to take your computer.
Yeah.
And secondly, you know, according to the wording of the press release that was on GP1, I'm not sure whether or not it was a laptop computer or one of the secondary computers that's just used, say, you know, to plug into the bike when you're on the grid. You know, there are other things that could be called electronics and computers that plug into the bike, either to take a reading or change a map just to check sensors on the bike, that it's not technically a computer. You know, it's a box with switches on it.
Sure.
So whether or not that was maybe the missing component or it's misplaced or what, I don't know. And I don't think anybody's laptop got stolen. And whether or not people's laptops have GPS and you know, full retinal scanners and whatnot and laser hand readers, you know, this is kind of funny. Most people use, you know, like a ThinkPad or,
yeah,
you know, a standard laptop with basic security on it. And, you know, as far as sharing information back and forth, you'd need a very specific person's computer to know anything. You know, secondly, even though everybody's running Magneti Marelli systems, or a lot of people are, you know, it's up to the factories to design the software that uses the Magneti hardware. You know, it's not a simple plug and play where you're going to, like, if you took someone's, a Dynajet or Power Commander
right.
from their CBR, you know, you could plug it into another CBR and hook it up to the dyno or take a look at the map that they've created and say, okay, ignition is like this, and at this RPM it changes here, and it's retarded 5 degrees here. You know, honestly, if someone showed me stuff from Suzuki, I'd say, I don't know what this means. You know, and if they showed me Yamaha stuff, I'd say, I don't know what this means. To believe that another factory would try and steal someone's laptop to discover how the system of the motorcycle works, it is so complex because every factory has a different philosophy on what sensors are important, you know, and you can see that, you know, as simply as in club racing here in America. You know, certain aftermarket systems you buy to build a traction control system, certain ones use wheel sensors on the front wheel and the back wheel, and they just measure wheel speed and then determines, oh, okay, your back is spinning, let's kick in the traction control. Whereas other systems run off the engine itself and off of sensors, you know, like a crank sensor, where you'd see, oh, okay, now the motor's spinning up faster than it should, so obviously the rear tire's slipping. And, you know, technically, I guess you can't call that traction control. It's more of an engine management system or an engine power modulator.
Well, Debbie, honestly, that's how Suzuki got away with an engine management system for several years when traction control was outlawed.
Thanks for saying it.
I remember sitting in turn two at Sears Point going, well, I know what that is. You know, I'm looking at actually, I think I was there with Bob and Jules. I'm like, do you guys understand what's going on there? Let me explain it to you.
The technical term is maybe the spark plugs were fouled.
Exactly. So, for a very temporary period of time.
The carbs were gummy. The carbs were gummy, and that's why it was cutting out.
Yeah.
The depth clogged.
Yeah. Yeah.
What else to cover?
I've got plenty. Okay, so there's kind of a combo thing here, and I'll do a segue into it. One of the things that I heard, and follow me on this, because what I'm going to do is go from Vittorio Guareschi, who is now the
Vito.
I know Vito is now the head of. Actually half a head, if you will, of
half a, there you go.
Yeah, of Factory Corsa's team. And Livio's gone. But, you know, I read something, and I think I had listened to an interview on MotoGP.com. He tested 10 unique bikes on the first day prior to them actually doing the official test at Sepang. And I just found that astounding that I can't think of any other time where a team chief did a whole bunch of testing just prior to a test, if you will. You know, I know he was the tester before, but I think it's pretty cool.
He was pretty quick.
Yeah.
Well, this is something a lot of people don't really seem to notice, but the fact is most chief mechanics or crew chief or what's the technical, track engineer, I think is the in vogue name for the person these days. You know, a lot of these guys are middle-aged. A lot of them haven't really ridden a bike in anger or even a track day in years. You know, I can't see Houseworth getting on a race bike and testing. So, but they used to.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing, when they were younger, I'm sure every single one of them rode motorcycles, and that's how they got enthusiastic and how they got into the industry. Now that Vito's a boss, you know, it's kind of an odd position because you think, well, did he work his way up to being the boss? How did he get to be the boss? And maybe he's only going to handle certain aspects of the management, where the second head, Matteo, is going to handle the business side of things. It's not for me to say. I know Vito. He's really cool. He's got goofy hair, nice sunglasses.
And
he's
that,
a nice guy, and, I
and,
think,
and a
I
funky
think
beard,
PR
a funky beard
it.
To boot.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the PR behind it is that they believe he's good friends with Valley, and you know, maybe that will ease some kind of negotiation with Rossi when his Yamaha contract is starting to go up. Personally, I think that if you have somebody of Valentino's stature in the racing community, and he mentions to anybody that he wants to talk or he would be interested in listening to something, it doesn't matter who the head is or the boss is, he will get to the right people.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's that much of an issue where you have to put, you know, I wouldn't see Ducati Corsa promoting Uccio somehow to being their race team boss just because he's best friends with Valley. You know, it's a non-issue for me. And ultimately, I just want to see the rider on the track. A lot of the intrigue and the contractual stuff that happens is it's annoying. And, you know, it's an unfortunate part of this business, racing, where you see, you know, one rider is promised a ride, but another rider can bring money. And then the first rider, who's already promised to the team that he's going to ride their bike, gets a better offer, so maybe he takes off. And, you know, ultimately you see Steve Rapp campaigning in 848. And, you know, hopefully he goes quick.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. There are. I went through the just a quick divergence here. I went through the Daytona Superbike list last night. As of yesterday, there were like 40 riders. There's 7 848s going to be there this year, which I think is actually really cool. There were none last year at all. So clearly DNA is actually picking up the slack because you're not going to see that many guys unless there's some backing. But back on track. So, Vito, but 10 bikes. That is what freaked me out. They pulled 10 bikes to Sepang. That's not easy stuff, man.
No. And it's hot there. I mean,
yeah.
To be honest with you, my memories of Sepang at testing are not fun because it's hot. And the problem with testing is it's boring for the most part because there's always a bike whirring around on track. There's always something going on and your rider's always coming in and going out and coming in and going out, and it feels like an endurance event.
Yeah.
And you're hoping that, you know, there's going to be some breakthrough with maybe a swing arm pivot point or, you know, a different suspension link or what have you. But, you know, honestly, my opinion of it is you just want the rider to get comfortable on the bike after the off season, and you want him to figure out his ultimate handlebar position and be comfortable moving around on the bike. And the best way to do that is with laps. You just put the laps in.
Yep.
You know, and step by step people improve. There was a lot of talk about Ben Spies improving in the timesheets at the Valencia test after the last race last year. One thing people forget is it's human nature to keep going faster on a racetrack the more time you have on it, uninterrupted. You know, the fact is he spent 3 days there getting ready for the test, you know, Friday, Saturday, and then the race on Sunday. Those are solid laps. Come Monday, Tuesday, when the testing started, he's had 3 days to build upon, and also there's more rubber on the track.
You know, absolutely.
Every lap that the bikes are doing is leaving
yep.
rubber in the corners.
Yep.
So therefore, the entire grid is getting faster from a physical standpoint simply because there's more rubber on the track, there's more traction. And two, human nature means the more you keep going around the same set of corners, the faster you're going to get at it. That's just a
true.
You know, one thing I wanted to point out.
You know, what was interesting, though, is overall, and I pointed this out in last week's show, the lap times that they ran in this, and you really can't compare, you know, Sepang's such a changeable track. That's exactly what I said. I think those are the exact words I said. So you can't compare one day to another, really. But they had 2 days. The second day was, you know, half rained out. But nobody went faster than last year. And, you know, I was trying to figure out if that was due to the motors, you know, the changes with the motors or the weather or whatever. But usually what we see, you know, by the second day, you've got guys that are, we're very used to records being broken. And the comparison that I was making was to QP from last year. You know, we didn't have qualifying tires, so you can kind of make a valid comparison.
Right.
I was surprised by that.
Well, typically, year to year, the bikes take a step forward.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the tires take a step forward. Now we're seeing Bridgestone as the spec supplier. Maybe they don't have to come up with a step forward. Because they work in concert with the factories to produce a bike that, that works well with the tire. And the factories also had to produce an engine that is going to last, you know, rather than make more power and not last as long. Now they've got to make, you know, hopefully the same amount of power and last longer. So I didn't really see a big concentration of development because of either a new tire or because of a more powerful engine.
That reminds me of something I remember Espleta saying last year, and actually I can't remember if it was reflected back by the Bridgestone folks, but I remember him saying that they, in effect, or to paraphrase, that they were thinking about dumbing down the tires to bring down speeds. And I'm like, screw that. But that's just from memory. I'm not even going to go there. Okay,
what
so
happened to Blue Sky?
Okay, I want to back up because I don't want to miss this. We talked about Vito, and the reason Vito is there is because Livio is no longer, and he is now at, he's wearing HRC colors, which is really weird. What do you think about that?
Well, maybe I mentioned to you before, but when Livio worked in Formula One, he worked with a certain manufacturer. So not such a big surprise to me to see him while working for a different team, because no matter where you are on the pecking order, you have a year contract. That's how it works in MotoGP.
True.
And this is so that, you know, for the benefit of the person, the individual, and the benefit of the team. You know, if this guy's not really working out or meshing well with the rest of the crew, then the team has the option of changing him out. And secondly, if the person gets a better offer from, say, another team or a team that's closer to home or more money, whatever, the person has the option to switch teams. And, it, you know, there's no hard feelings because, hey, the contract was 1 year. I fulfilled my duties, my obligation. Time to change. To see him in HRC colors will definitely be a little bit of a shock. But I'm not perfectly clear as to what his role is because that particular team has so many people involved. I'm not sure if he'll be working directly for Repsol or working directly for HRC. They have different groups within the organization that's presented as one team.
Sure.
So I don't know exactly what his job is, but I'm sure he's going to be just fine doing it because he's a professional and he likes racing.
I think for a lot of people, you know, because he's been there so long, he was kind of the face of Factory Corsa, it's just
only because certain people celebrated photos of him smoking Marlboros while he was wearing Marlboro colors.
you may have a very valid point right there. All right, let's roll off of that one because I could go on and on. Let's talk about a couple of other things. What are your thoughts? And I think, if you know, at first I was like really pushing back because I'm getting better about accepting change in my life. I better be. Moto 2, what do you think?
Moto 2, good stuff. Really not enough of the type of development I was hoping for with the Moto 2 chassis. I think the bottom line is everybody's going to try and maximize corner speed, as usual, because this is a 600. Theoretically, it should spin better than an 800cc around a corner, but it's a production-based motor, so we might be dealing with a crankshaft that's too heavy, you know, in relation to how much they weigh in the 800s. And the fact is, people have to use the same gearbox. So it's going to be different track by track as far as, you know, how well these bikes will work on different racetracks. Secondly, I didn't see any big innovations as far as, you know, swing arms in the front,
yeah,
or dual rear shocks, or just, you know, anything that was not considered a standard racing bike these days. Everybody seems to have made a chassis to fit around the Honda motor, and they're just going to go racing. And, you know, the first couple races and events are going to see where everything shakes out. and we'll probably see the pecking order, because I can't believe that the development of the Moto 2 bikes is going to be anywhere near as fast as a GP bike with a factory behind it. You know, if you've got a specialist manufacturer, you know, someone like Morawaki, yes, they're going to field a couple bikes for different teams. They're going to see what starts breaking. They're going to work on improving reliability first of components, and also trying to figure out how to go faster. But it's really difficult to shift into high gear and produce 10 chassis that are identical, you know, as one run, and then try and produce 10 more, and so on and so forth. You know, ultimately, the pecking order will be that their main team will get the better chassis first, and then those will get handed down to the second team, and new ones will come to the first team, and it'll just be a continuation as it's always been, where we see Aprilia chassis, the RSAs, were going to the factory team, and the second gen bikes or last year's bikes were the number two team, and all the way down the order. That's what I see for Moto 2. As far as the maybe messy 1,000cc production-based motor in MotoGP and an 800cc Blue Sky Engineering engine with restrictors, that seems ugly to me. Like, there's a whole bunch of mess that can happen with that. You know, where would somebody like Honda be in that situation? Would they say, okay, we're going to produce a street bike motor, a production motor with an 81-millimeter bore, and then we're going to have our Blue Sky engine? And honestly, how much, you know, depending on which one's competitive, which one are they going to sink more money into? Would you spend a couple of million, you know, working on the production engine, knowing that everyone's going to have an 81-millimeter bore for their street bike, whether it's BMW or Aprilia or any, you know, Yamaha? What are they going to do? How much more are they going to be able to get out of staying with a Blue Sky motor as opposed to running a production-based motor? I honestly see Honda focusing more on the production-based motor simply because of the world economy. Honda's that much bigger than everybody else. Therefore, when the economy slumps, Honda's losing that much more. And I've already seen the changes affected, you know, as early as the beginning of 2009, how they were trying to save money. And even the current HRC head that's running the team has said, I was brought in to cut costs. And that's why the bike is not, you know, changing as rapidly, or that's why we don't have this. Simply because the money crunch has hit everybody.
Your point is well taken, but one of the things that I wonder is, you know, in theory this is all, but I still want to touch on Moto 2 with you, but the 1,000cc thing in theory is only supposed to occur in 2012. And when I was having a conversation with Jason DeSalvo a couple of weeks ago for the show, because he's riding for Factory Triumph now in World Supersport, you know, now they have a four-person team. I said, it's really wise to invest now if you have the resources, because there's no doubt the economy is eventually going to jump back.
Right.
And so if you have the opportunity to put your resources into what you're doing now, you might as well do it. Now, the question is, do these factories have the capability of doing that? And I guess the basic answer is no, because there's no doubt that the motorcycle industry from a retail standpoint is, you know, hurting bad. And, you know, the numbers are very public. But I guess we'll have to see. All right. I think we're near the – oh, Moto 2. I still wanted to ask you about that. Lorenzo, you heard about him breaking his wrist, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I honestly think a rider of his caliber. About
caliber. Second,
well, in MotoGP at least, pretty much everybody uses Brembo brake systems,
sure.
With the exception of a private team like Gresini that's been using Nissan. They use them, I think, the last 2 years now. Previously, Nissan was with Dantin Ducati in 2006, and they were also with Kenny Roberts' team. So Nissan is the other supplier of high-end brake components for MotoGP racing. I've seen Nissan brakes on Hiro Aoyama's Interwetten bike. So obviously Nissan is stepping up from supplying just Gresini Hondas. Now they're also supplying Aoyama, which I think that's going to be so good for feedback, because the guy that handles Nissan racing at the racetrack you know, he's Japanese, and Hiro's Japanese, and we've had dinner together, and they're good friends. So I think the feedback hopefully allows Nissan to step up and hopefully allows them to start producing equipment that other teams want to use, because then it would provide more parity, and it wouldn't be so much Brembo, which, you know, I'm all for having as many manufacturers and as many different parts as you can get in the series, especially now that, you know, you're limited to using Bridgestones for the tires, and you're limited to using a Honda in Moto 2. So I want more people to get involved.
Now, you would laugh, because besides the fact that we completely went off track there,
All right. Lorenzo, yes, he broke his wrist. And for a rider of his caliber, missing a few days at Sepang is not going to be a difference. We've seen how fast he got up to speed on a GP bike. We saw his incredible four races when he started riding the Fiat Yamaha. I think a broken wrist is going to set him back a little bit time-wise while he needs to heal, but I don't think his talent is going anywhere, and I don't think his resolve to beat Valentino is going anywhere. What it means is we're going to see Ben Spies maybe a rung higher in the finishing order, and everybody else, you know, that would be behind Lorenzo as far as preseason testing. But I don't think Lorenzo is going to have any problems coming back from it.
More interesting,
when you want to talk about hand and arm injuries, more interesting was the fact that Hayden got surgery in Spain for a potential arm pump issue, as opposed to coming back during the three-week break and getting it worked on by Dr. Ting here in Fremont, California.
I saw that.
I don't know why. Yeah, I don't know why that happened, but you know, he had the work done. So
yeah, that was definitely, and that was just a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that you often jest with me about this, because you give me grief sometimes because you think I don't recognize changes, and I know that there's nobody that does this as well as you, especially when it comes to
Neil Spaulding does it better than me.
But
Neil has a little bit more data to draw from, and everybody's a little bit easier on him with a camera.
True. But if you, and I know you haven't listened to last week's show yet, but you will note, if you do listen to the show, that I noted in the show that there were a lot of kind of oddball things about the inner Witten. And, you know, when you've got these bikes that are basically all black, it's kind of hard to, you know, pick out tiny little details. But, you know, that I also get these massive high-res pictures, and I can pick things out and contrast and compare.
But what'd you notice?
I noticed the Nissans. The swing arm was way different. The cutouts in the fairing, the swing arm looked like a 2008 swing arm, and I'm like, well, that's odd.
Not really. When you consider that Hiro's coming into GP now, and he didn't ride the bike in 2008 or 2009.
True.
What they really need to do is create a baseline bike for him, which is what preseason's for. Which swing arm do you like better? Boom. Okay, this is going to be your swing arm.
Okay.
So, not uncommon to see that. We saw it when Biaggi and Gibernau had ridden the factory Hondas, and they went back and forth with the swing arms. So not too much different there. I will say that the factory HRC swing arm looks massive.
Yes, it does.
You know, I kind of feel that if they really get on the gas coming out of a corner, I'm wondering if the swing arm's going to drag on the ground. Like, it's big. You know, that would be hilarious.
Okay, so I have a potentially touchy question. I can even edit this out if you don't want to answer it. I had a very polite argument with Julian Ryder about the RS250 that Hiro was riding last year. And Julian swore up and down. He's like, no, they've done no development on it. I'm like, dude, they have to have done some development on it. They're beating RSAs, you know, and all over the place. What do you think?
Well, I want to compliment Julian Ryder on being such a great personality.
Okay.
He's so funny and astute about a lot of things. He's one of the few people I think that can cut his hair and his beard with the same set of clippers or a Flobee. You know, I don't know if they still sell the Flobee in England, but I would say that there are a lot of old parts on that particular bike. But I would also say that it's been tuned. Whether or not you want to call that development, you know, I guess contractually, Honda is supplying the parts, HRC is supplying the parts, but you know, what the team does with those parts. You know, maybe they had a little bit more freedom this past year to work with those parts and see what they could do. Touchy subject, huh? I don't know if it's a touchy subject. I mean, ultimately, Honda won the last 250 World
Indeed.
Championship.
Indeed.
You know, so that's amazing to me. And personally,
I know,
as I've been around the GP bikes, I had a chance to crawl around Bautista's and DiMeglio's factory RSAs, the Aprilia, and the Aprilia was just flat-out amazing to me. I thought it was beautiful from so many different standpoints, whether you wanted to say from a technical standpoint. The fact is, compared to a Honda, they did so many things artistically with bolt placement and using eccentric adjusters for things like the foot peg hangers. Whereas the Honda might be more basic, you're going to have four holes that are all drilled and tapped, and you position things where you want in one of the four holes. You know, the Aprilia might have eccentrics. And it was just such a gorgeous machine. And I can't believe that a non-developed Honda, last ridden by Danny Pedrosa in 2005, would have anywhere near the legs to run with an RSA. So in answer to that question, I think there was some work put into Hero's bikes.
You kind of tiptoed around that. Well done.
Hey, I have to be diplomatic. I like all brands and all manufacturers.
I know.
Hey, I especially love Kawasaki.
You and me both, brother. You know what I write.
Well, I don't know. I'm just teasing.
Hey. Okay. So,
last cool Kawasaki was ridden by Akira Yanagawa.
But
then he crashed out.
Yeah,
I was like, I love that tail section on that bike. It was so outrageous.
It was cool.
It was a good looking bike. It was a good bike.
And a question for you, along with the last 250 championship. I know your pals with Hero. Did you talk to him after winning his championship?
Yeah, but you know, he's so modest and humble anyway.
Yeah.
I just think it's fantastic. You know, when we've all been hoping for him to get into GP for so many years, and he had, you know, a factory contract at one point that he turned down to stay in 250s, and I can't mention any names, but you know, the fact is he's been on the cusp of being one of the good riders, especially from Japan, to break into MotoGP, and to win the last championship and then move up to a Honda, or with Honda, it's fantastic. And I'm really happy to see that there was no apparent bad blood from Honda when he left the Movie Star team at the end of his two-year contract and then went to KTM.
Mm-hmm.
I am very, very relieved to see that you know, after KTM pulled out, that Honda, you know, took him back, and then he was able to repay them with the championship. And then that they brought him up to GP is fantastic. You know, it's a really golden opportunity for him. And he's a person that values hard work and understands the dedication it takes to put into being a champion. And I wish him more than the best.
I remember at the end of 2007, you and I had talked and we were kind of looking at what was going on with him, and things were actually at some point kind of dire, and it was, you know...
Yes, it was critical after Malaysia.
Yeah.
2007, we were like, holy smokes, I can't believe this.
Yeah.
That means I'm not going to buy a Super Duke. so I don't own a Super Duke. And as much as I love the RC8, and it's incredibly comfortable, and man, when you hang off that bike, you just feel like every part of your body locks into that bike. Incredible bike. I don't own one of those either.
Right.
I speak with my wallet.
Yeah, indeed. You and me both, especially right now.
As a consumer.
Yes.
As a consumer. But man, that's a pretty bike.
All right. You know, I've taken a... Wait, what? Oh, fire away.
BMW.
Okay.
That's a lot of horsepower out of a 1,000cc bike for the street.
And the dyno numbers that I'm seeing look like they're not...
More than a Busta.
They're not... Yeah, they're not bullshit.
More than a Busta.
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
And it's relatively cheap. Yeah.
I don't know what you mean by that. Have you seen BMW's add-on package?
No, well, yeah, but I mean...
You cannot get out of a dealership with a bone stock bike. It seems like they're like, Steel. And you got to get the heated grips with a quick shifter for those chilly track days. If you plan to take it to the track, you might need a leather suit, and you might have to take off the all-season touring gear.
I know for a fact that there are ways to get it with in basically near raceable condition.
In real form, but why would you want to? With that much power, the fact that they offer a comprehensive engine management system and the ABS brakes for only 5 pounds, why not? I mean, well, if you can turn it off, try it.
You know why? Because you like to ride on the street, and I only ride on the track. So I want one use, you know, single use only, if you will. Well, multi-use, but on the track only. I've taken up enough of your time, and I thank you so much, Liam. It's been great to talk to you again, and hopefully we'll do it again soon.
Absolutely. When's the next test, Jim?
The next test, we've got Moto 2 and 125s this coming weekend.
Running right now. I thought they were running the 11th through the 13th.
No, they're anyway. Barcelona. I'm shifting dates in my head because I'm trying to pretend like we're actually doing this interview closer to when I actually publish the podcast.
One thing everybody in MotoGP land should know is that we are time travelers.
And on top of that, and you need to go listen to the last podcast, dude.
Everybody, you're so proud that you noticed some changes on the bike.
Oh, shut up. Well, no, you know why? Because you always gave me shit about it before.
No, I didn't.
Well, you're like, what are the changes? I mean, I got no idea, and you're like,
did you see the Desmo Sedici front fender?
Well, not only the fender, but the cowling openings seem to be quite reshaped. But yeah, I did notice.
I do like that curvy tail section. That's a really nice touch.
Yeah, they were very. It was very.
Makes you wonder.
Yeah. It was very sharp. It was very sharp last year.
Well, it matched the 10.98, 8.48 tail section.
True.
But I wonder, and I'm just putting this out there for astute listeners, if this has anything to do with a new street bike that Ducati is going to unveil later this year, which might have a similarly shaped tail section. I don't know. They've been known to do that.
I'll just leave that clue hanging.
All right, everybody. Take care. Yeah. Jim, great talking to you.
Indeed.
And if anybody has any questions or comments, feel free to send me an email. Do not comment through my website because it's been corrupted, and I get more spam than the state of Hawaii at this point. So just shoot me a direct email at liam@motoliam.com.
Cool. And we'll talk to you again soon. Really want to thank Liam for that. There was a whole lot of information that he passed on, and I'm really glad he took the time to do so. And hopefully we'll have him back on the show again soon. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I love hearing Liam's bits because the insight he has is, you know, however much of an armchair experts that I might like to think I am or, you know, any of the guys out there, having been in the paddock and with the technical expertise he has, Liam can just kind of cut straight to the heart of it. But he also will look at things from a different perspective, which I always find is incredibly enlightening on those things. But that's really good, really good. Particularly the Moto2 stuff is going to be absolutely fascinating, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. And so thanks again, Liam. Lastly, I think for this show, you guys will remember last week that we talked about FTR, and they're doing those limited edition Haslam Elfana specials. And there was something I actually read today, which was funny. They thought that it was that Ron Haslam must be rolling over in his non-grave because he's still quite alive and still riding motorcycles, but that they're using a Honda 600 to celebrate the, you know, 500 GP era, and I'm like, you know, no. And I shot off a note to Leon to see if he could ask Dad what he thought of it, but I'm sure that he's all good with it, especially if, you know, you get 3 days at a show. Anyway, or it is race school. Anyway, I communicated with the FTR folks, and when I originally speculated on this, you know, how much the bike was going to cost, I was thinking U.S. dollars somewhere in the $250,000 range, because there's only 10 of them, right? No. The price, at least to me, sounds relatively reasonable. It is 69, it's basically 70,000 pounds plus VAT and delivery. So, figure what, 80? Doesn't sound like that bad of a deal. You're essentially getting a Moto 2 bike, although a first generation Moto 2 bike, with a motor built by basically a World Supersport spec motor, probably a little bit dialed down a little bit, so the thing lasts a little bit longer. But I want one.
That they look absolutely gorgeous, don't they?
Yep.
I'd love one.
And I got the full specs for it. I think I did. I forward that to you? If I haven't forwarded that to you, I will. It's full of all sorts of the best bits that you can put on a motorcycle. Okay, 80 grand is still a lot of money. Don't get me wrong.
Is that
But
$80,000 you're
80,
thinking?
80,000, 80,000 pounds in figure is
Yeah,
about what you're looking at. Yeah.
it's I've just run a quick currency converter. It's just under $110,000, £70,000 would be. So
But
with delivery, yeah.
I thought it was going to be twice that.
Yeah, it's not bad.
Yeah, it isn't bad. But there's only 10. So if you happen to have a whole bunch of extra cash laying.
And how hard are you going to push that the first time you take it on a track day?
I have a feeling a lot of those are going to be gracing people's living rooms, and collections. Or what you do is you pull off the totally cool body work, you throw on something else, because ultimately what you want is that look. The look is just going to be so cool. But all right, Martin, thank you again. That was fun.
No problem at all. The only other thing I would like to say is
Sure.
happy 31st birthday, Valentino, last Tuesday.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Can't believe he's 31.
I can't either.
How old does that make us feel, huh? Ross is like, he's a kid. He still looks like a kid.
I prefer you don't ask questions like
No.
that. Oh, yeah. Happy birthday. It's been a busy week for both of us. And I wish you the best, and we will talk to you again soon. You got some great feedback from our listeners, so
I was as flattered as I was surprised, and yeah, no, it's great. Unfortunately, I'm stuck in, or I'm off down to Cornwall next week to do a couple of days' duty at a base down there, so I won't be around next week. But I don't
no
half
worries.
look forward to listening to the podcast.
Cool. Thanks again, and we will talk to you again soon, Martin. Have a good week.
Brilliant. Cheers, Jim. Thanks all. Ta-da.
MotoGP is a trademark of Dorna Sports SL. The MotoGP OD podcast and MotoGPOD.com are not affiliated with Dorna Sports SL. All other trademarks are the property of their respective owners. MotoGP OD isn't affiliated with any of them.